Good morning, Maine. Welcome to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310. In just a few minutes, we'll be playing my interview with one of my favorite authors, Paul Dworn. Just came out with a new book I'm holding right here in front of me there, Deb. It's called The Precipice. It's so cool that Maine has so many great authors. And obviously everyone knows Stephen King, who's probably the most prolific and probably the most well-known worldwide. Mm-hmm. But we have Tess Gerritsen, who was in here a few weeks ago, who writes many books, and she's well-known for her series of books that was turned into a TV series, Rizzoli and Isles. And then we have Paul Dworn with his new book, Precipice, which is part of the Mike Bowditch series.
I wonder if they'll make a movie out of this.
I wish they would.
Or a series.
Yeah. I think it's going to be big.
I think so, too.
And the series is big, and he's just one of the nicest guys.
Yeah.
He used to be the editor at Down East Magazine, which I think is one of our great magazines. So he'll be here, and we'll be playing the interview that we did with him in about 8 minutes, but we've got a bunch of stuff.
Yes, we do.
You going to put it all on me, or do you have anything?
I'm going to let you go first.
Really? Okay,
yeah.
I'll go first. Bar Harbor.
Bar Harbor.
Wow, I just spent 4 days there.
Isn't it amazing up there?
Anyone listening, whether it's three people or 3,000 right now, if you're listening to the voice of Steve-O on Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, plan a trip to Bar Harbor if you haven't been there. And if you have been there, you should be going often. Maine has so many beautiful places, but in my mind, it is one of the most idyllic.
Yeah.
We stayed right downtown at the Harborside Hotel.
Nice.
And then this Bar Island, which at low tide, the bar, sandbar, shows up. It's amazing. You walk across.
Did you go out?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Oh. And then we went up to Acadia and went up to Cadillac Mountain. And then have you ever been to Bubble Rock?
No.
Which is like this giant boulder that looks like it's teetering on the side of the mountain.
Oh.
My son, Zach, tried to push it over.
Oh.
Yeah.
I go,
what are you doing? And he goes, I don't know. It just looks like it's teetering. I go, yeah, but you're not going to, you know, and it's the size of like a bus.
Yeah, but what an amazing thing if he had succeeded.
amazing, unless you were a hiker down below.
Well.
I don't think a hiker down below would look up and go, that is. Yeah, boy. Yeah, so everyone should go up to Bar Harbor and enjoy that. It's just Acadia Park is one of the natural treasures we have up here.
Exactly.
What else do we have going on? Donald Trump this week announced he's running for president.
Yes, he did, yeah.
How can anyone take that seriously?
I hear that all the time. I don't understand why people don't take him seriously. Why?
Are you serious?
Now,
I can't take you serious.
Question.
If you're asking me why, we're going to get into a death spiral
serious?
Here. You, I can't take you seriously now. If you don't see that he's a goofy guy with goofy
Would
hair.
Would he be competent to run for president, in your opinion, yes or no?
I think asking the question represents something that's bizarre. Answering it would be equally bizarre.
Why? He's a successful businessman.
He inherited money from his dad. He's a pushy, obnoxious guy.
He's way beyond his father wealth-wise.
Well, it doesn't mean anything, so he's a good business guy.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean anything.
It doesn't mean anything?
He's a kook.
He knows quite a bit about business. I would say that's a trade deal.
He hired people to go to Hawaii to look for President Obama's birth certificate. He says crazy things like he knows how to wipe out ISIS. And then somebody asks, well, how would you do it? I'm not telling until later.
I don't know.
Do you say that? You know how to wipe out ISIS? Quick, tell us.
I think people have a problem with him because he's blunt and direct.
Oh,
he doesn't sugarcoat anything.
Well, yeah, a lot of kooks don't sugarcoat anything. That's not a qualification.
Well, some people out there like it. The way it's presented is more important than the actual message being spoken.
I can see his first state dinner as President Trump. Hey, you, Saudi Arabian king, get out of here, you big knucklehead. Get out of here. Get his food away from him. I don't like him.
Oh, dear.
Yeah. I mean, part of being president is to, you know, and again, I don't want to compare that to our governor, Paul LePage, but haven't we learned anything over the last 5 years in terms of blunt, you know, people not being tactful or being
Or being inexperienced like our president?
What are you talking about?
He wasn't experienced enough to be president when he came
on board. Experienced in what? He's a U.S. senator.
Oh, Oh. So he doesn't have to be experienced in anything, but Donald Trump doesn't know anything.
I didn't say he didn't know anything. He can build the building. He can clear out a site and put up a hotel. He can bankrupt 4 hotels in Atlantic City faster than any other human being in the world. How do you bounce back from that? How do you bounce back from his business success where almost every casino he's ever built has gone bankrupt?
Gee, I don't know. For a guy who's worth over $8 billion with a B, there's got to be something that he's done right.
He put that on a form he submitted.
Okay.
I'm going to fill out a form today.
Are you?
Saying I belong on the cover of GQ because of my fabulous good looks, and I'm worth $50 billion. It doesn't make it true.
You're identifying with that profile?
No, I'm just saying it hasn't been proven. He put out a form that he's worth, it's like $9 billion. It's like he's just awful. And you don't want to make that connection between him and Governor LePage, do you?
Did I make that connection?
No, I think I did, but I'm trying to put it on you.
Oh, okay. Well, you can put it on me if you want.
I know, but, you know, LePage had experience at Martin's. He wasn't the owner of Martin's.
Right. He had about
He wasn't
as much...
the president. He was the head of operations.
Yeah.
He wasn't the mayor of Waterville.
I think...
He was a symbolic mayor because they had a weak mayor system, and he was part of the city council. It's like all this hype. It's just not real. And having an angry person lead us... An angry person running the military, an angry person. Can you imagine Trump running the military?
There were a lot of presidents who were angry, cranky old man.
He's not just angry. He's like, I'm telling you, let's go blow up Central America. Let's go. Let's go. I just said it. Come on. You see my hair? My hair's not shaking. I'm serious. That's what he would do. Crazy. Okay.
Okay.
Wow.
That was
Boy,
crazy.
Boy, you're getting me all,
You
are. To suggest that Donald Trump could be our next president
If Barack Obama could be president, anybody could be president, in my opinion.
Take it back. Anyhow, what do we got going here? Hey, have you been following all this smoky carnival stuff? Kids have gotten hurt.
Yeah.
I went on the record, I think, 4 years ago in Yarmouth, because the same smoky carnival group, they come to the Yarmouth Clam Festival.
Yeah.
And I wrote a letter to the sound manager saying, I'm concerned about this carnival operation. And as a person who has done events for 35 years, big events, concert events, sporting events, I am somewhat versed on logistics and operations. And you go to these carnivals and it looks like things are put together with duct tape.
I know.
And crazy glue. And many of the people working there, because of the economics of the carnival, don't look like they're, you know, they have an engineering degree. they don't look like they've showered for 2 weeks.
Oh, I know.
And here's the defense of the carnival operator. We got our inspection. Yeah, we passed the inspection. And what does that mean?
I know.
Maybe there's something wrong with the inspectors.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, maybe they give the inspectors cotton candy. And say, hey.
In a free ride at the carnival?
Have a couple. Here's 2 candy apples, some cotton candy, and some lemonade.
That's bad.
I don't know what the answer is, but the economics of carnivals are so tough that I don't think they're able to put adequate money into safety and the engineering. And I'm concerned.
Yeah, agreed.
Anyhow, we covered Bar Harbor. We talked about Donald Trump, which just seems ridiculous. I think you say things just to kind of like...
Just to get you going.
I think so. The Trump thing is just... anyhow, we should get to the interview with Paul Dwern.
Yes.
What a nice guy. One of our nicest guests. This was the second time here.
Mm-hmm.
We should have given him a gift. When people come here, we should have a...
We should have a hat or
coffee mug or something.
T-shirt,
Sully,
something.
We need to get on that. We need to do Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O coffee
there
mugs.
There you go.
Yeah, a little keepsake to remember, just to cherish.
With a nice picture of Steve-O on the front.
Oh, yeah. That would really add to the memories. Yeah, thanks. Thanks for that little dig.
Anytime I can help.
Anyhow, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLAB. Let's go to our interview with author Paul Dwern.
Size. Well, lately when I look into your eyes,
down, down, down. Listening to Time Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk of LLB. You know why we picked down, 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 Deb?
Tell me.
Our guest, our very special guest, is the former editor-in-chief of Down East magazine.
Nice.
That's the only connection we needed.
That's
plus, I really like Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah, me too.
Welcome, Paul Dworn. How are you doing, Paul?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me back.
It's great having you here. Not only are you known, I think, in Maine for the great work at Down East magazine, but you're also one of our eminent authors. And as you were here about a year or two ago, and I expressed my jealousy for your success in your career because I've been stuck. My writing career was stuck on the whole colon, semicolon hurdle. And it's, you know, for 30 years, I've tried writing columns and tried writing essays. And I've got like 10 copies of Strunk and White, the grammar book. I can't get over it. And here you are, successful, here to talk about your latest book that is just coming out called The Precipice. And it officially just launched on June 16th, right?
It did. Yeah, it's my sixth novel, which astonishes me as much as it does anybody else. I can't believe it's been...
No, you brought a copy. Can I see the copy right
there?
The thing about a book, and I've been in love with books and reading since my earliest memories, and there's something profound about even just, you know, Deb, you don't get to borrow this. You
know,
same thing with you, Sully, because Paul brought this in for me, and I'm sure it's available. It's The Precipice, a novel by Paul Dworn, here, available now on probably all the electronic bookstores, right?
Yes,
Amazon, and plus all the traditional bookstores.
Audio, too.
Audio. Did you have to record the audio yourself?
No, they have never asked me to do that. I'm actually a little insulted that...
Wow. What would they say? You have like the face for radio, so we don't want to use your voice or something like that?
Well, the truth is that I cannot do a Maine accent despite being a Maine native.
Oh, that may be the hurdle. But holding the book, the idea that you and I want to talk about your writing process again, the whole idea that you could go into a room with metaphorically nothing but blank pages of paper and produce thousands of words and storylines and then work with a publishing company and have a book produced. And this is the hardcover. This isn't do it yourself in your backyard. I know a lot of people self-publish, and I think in any way and anyhow somebody can get their art or their writing out is great, and so I'm not going to be critical of that. But self-publishing, like Deb, you self-publish like your own little gardening book, and you know, every time you do something.
It's great.
Well, don't you?
Everything I can, yes.
You just publish and, you know, you send it to relatives and stuff.
Sure.
It goes on the internet.
People who get it.
Yeah. But this, I'm holding Paul's new book, The Precipice, and it's great art, and it's a book, and it has his picture in the back. And so I've read the synopsis, and I've read a couple of chapters available online, and I want to talk about the details. But just holding the book, I'm fascinated by it. I know this is irrational because you're a writer and you want to talk about the storyline and the character development, but somebody who produces something...
it's not irrational at all.
I'm impressed by just that.
I appreciate that because I'm impressed by it as well. I mean, I work on these things for a year, year and a half, and there's all kinds of stages along the way where my editor calls me up and says, I love it or I hate it. I have to work on it more, or they show me the cover art, but there's nothing that replaces the moment that I get the box from UPS on my doorstep and I open it up and there's an actual physical book there. Yeah. That's when it really feels real to me.
Yeah, because up until then, it is a little bit in the abstract. It's not a thing. It's a process. But once it goes to press and once it's locked in, I want to jump around a little bit in terms of your experience here in Maine and your background and also working with Down East, which is one of my favorite magazines. But listen, since you were talking about the process, how did this book start? And I know it's part of the Bowditch series, so people who are familiar with your other books will, you know, the character kind of lives on. But does the publishing house commission writing this, or do you write it and then sell it in through your agent? And you mentioned that when you would submit part of the writing, they would give you feedback, you know, or do you just write it all and send it to them and say, here it is, don't even change a comma? How collaborative is it with the publishing, and how much of it is a kind of an isolated experience for you as the writer?
Well, it is a collaborative process ultimately, and that's one of the things I like about working with one of the bigger publishers as opposed to, say, self-publishing things, is that people bring really great ideas to the, you know, to the editing, to the art, to the marketing. But they leave me to my own devices for the most part. I have a contract for, at this stage, that book and one more book. And they just let me go wild with the idea. In fact, they don't even check in with me for months at a time, to the point where it becomes a little nervous that I don't want to do something that's, you know, that they're going to violently object to. And fortunately, that didn't happen with this book. When I told them that I wanted to write about the Appalachian Trail, they were ecstatic because they knew that was a subject that was of interest to a lot of people.
This book, as well as many of your recent books, are all tied into the Mike Bowditch series of crime novels. Is the next book also specific to the series, or are you moving into a different subject?
No, the next book is also going to be, it'll be the seventh book in the Bowditch series. You know, they're doing well. I mean, everybody wants to know what's going to happen to him next,
right.
And I would be a fool not to pay attention to that. And, you know.
I've enjoyed it. In fact, I want to get to some part of it. I don't want to be a spoiler on the book, because I was on the edge of my seat just reading the preface. But when we were talking before you came in with Deb and with Sully here, we were talking about the genre of the crime novel, mm-hmm. and how you've kind of placed that here in Maine with the Appalachian Trail, and a lot born from, I'm guessing, your personal experience. And they were like, well, yeah, that's nice. He's involved with crime. And I'm saying, involved with crime? You didn't get to the page where he was talking.
Oh, you're not going to say it.
Well, I think we can. I think we can. I think we owe it to our listeners.
Okay.
You know, because Sully and Deb here, they wanted to talk about the Appalachian Trail and the Kennebunk River. And there's an element in the book where they go to Popham Beach. And so any of our listeners are familiar with those landmarks. But then you get down, and all of a sudden, Mike, the main character, meets Stacy. Wow. Stacy is a biologist, right? So she starts as a biologist. So her character is defined by, you know, great accomplishment, and her dad was really successful. And then all of a sudden, Mike and Stacy, let's see, we already got 4 months.
A little steamy, do that?
I'm trying to see which parts I can read. This is... I didn't know that your character had so many shades of gray. I'm just to mix genres. Stacy was a biologist, and it was a forest. She was a couple. I was almost 30, and then we went to the little cabin. And I'll leave it to our listeners.
Imagination is always probably better than reality, but
wow. it is a confession to make, and then all of a sudden. So it's a steaming relate. Before we get to the crime element where two hikers are missing, Mike is really starting to broaden his his interest, because in the earlier books, it was more, you know, it was about crime and it was about detail.
Well, yeah. You know, the funny thing about the series has been that this is the sixth book, and Mike's had a few girlfriends in the interim here before he ends up meeting with Stacy, and she's certainly a complicated character, and which is, you know, fits right in with the women he's attracted to. But you know, ultimately, I'm writing about this character, and he's sort of developing and growing. And I think what people respond to is the fact that he makes mistakes, and he feels very real to people. And that's one thing that's really important to me, that they respond to that. You know, my readers respond to him at that level, because I read a lot of crime fiction too, and I enjoy a good mystery, a good thriller, but I also, you know, miss a lot of really good human stories. And
right.
I feel like that's one of the things I'm trying to do. And, you know, a good steamy scene never hurts.
Well, you mentioned he dated before. And,
yeah.
And I'm guessing his previous love interest would be a little bit disappointed to hear that the first time he slept with Stacy, it was the most intense sexual experience he ever had.
Oh, man.
And so the previous girlfriends read that and go, wow, that puts everyone else.
What are you talking about?
And then they go into physical intimacy versus emotional intimacy, but there's very, very steamy. By the way, we have Paul Duard here in the studio. He is, for many years, was the editor-in-chief of Down East Magazine, really did a great job of anchoring that great publication. And he is also one of Maine's most successful and most prolific writers of a series of books, the Mike Bowditch series, and the current book that just came out, hot off the press, that I'm not even going to lend to Deb because she doesn't return my books. The Precipice is here. Let's jumping around a little bit, and we covered this last year or 2 years ago when you were here, but talk a little bit about both how you came to Maine, because I think your relationship with Maine is really interesting and how you kind of integrate that in your books, and then talk a little bit about how you transition from other forms of writing to being a novelist.
Sure. Well, I grew up in Scarborough, and my family is, you know, Franco-American Sanford shoemakers. But like a lot of kids who are from Maine, especially people who were growing up in Maine, maybe in the 70s and 80s, I had this feeling that my life was going to take place someplace else. And I was pretty eager to get out of here. But then, you know, one thing led to another and life didn't work out the way I planned. I ended up back in my parents' basement, in my early 20s, and a number of things happened at that point. I began to rediscover my love of the outdoors, which was something that was important to me when I was a little kid. And I also began to rediscover my love of writing. And the short answer to your question is Maine is a great place to be a writer, and especially a great place to be a writer if your interests are the natural world, people who are complicated but authentic, which I think Mainers are unusual in a modern America, maybe that way. It's something that people respond to here. But then on the professional level, I was also really fortunate that I was one of these Maine kids that once I did come back, I found jobs that enabled me to stay. And, you know, the ultimate job for me was landing at Down East Magazine, where I started as an associate editor, became managing editor, and then eventually editor-in-chief for 8 years before, again, I was lucky enough to be able to leave to write my novels full-time, which, again, is, you know, a dream. So it's been a really charmed life in lots of different ways. And, you know, as a Maine native, again, I would love to see other opportunities for people who do grow up here to come back, to stay, to make really interesting, successful lives, you know? So it's a cause that's actually really dear to my heart.
So talk a little, I mean, since the nature and the outdoors play a big role, what elements growing up kind of connected with you? You know, I spent last weekend in Bar Harbor and staying in Bar Harbor and then obviously going up to Cadillac Mountain because without popovers, I mean, why would anyone even go to Acadia without those popovers?
Exactly. They're pretty good.
Pretty good. And they're very stingy there at the Jordan Pond House, right? So you order a sandwich and they, you know, if you order a sandwich, they bring you like one popover. It's not like, you know, a Texas Roadhouse where you get a bunch of rolls, you know, which is another one of my favorite places. So I'm up there at Jordan Pond Saturday or Sunday and I'm like, hey, can I have another popover? And they're just stingy. They're like, well, you can, but you have to pay another $2.50. And I'm like, okay. And so, so I agree with what you said earlier about place being here in Maine, so unique and so powerful in so many ways. The combination of the ocean, which I think has its mm-hmm. own profound connection to people or many people. One of my favorite books growing up was Siddhartha, and one of the characters, mm-hmm. the ferryman, talks about the water as being mm-hmm. a metaphor for kind of looking inside oneself. But were you in Boy Scouts? Did you hike around? Did you do canoeing?
Oh, yeah. I know. I was that kind of kid who, you know, my mom every evening had to like open the window and shout for me because I was outside, you know, trying to catch frogs or fireflies, or I just did not want to come inside. And then when I was inside, I was reading all the time. And so, I mean, one of the big epiphanies in my life, to use a fancy word, was just realizing that that was what I was supposed to be writing about, was my love of the Maine outdoors. And, you know, what I find is that when readers show up at my book signings or send me emails, I mean, that's what I'm hearing, is that they feel my love for the Maine outdoors in my writing and really respond to it at that same level.
And the writing itself, looking here at my notes, you attended Yale.
I did.
I don't know if you know this, Deb. Do you know this?
Tell me.
That I spent some time at Yale.
Really?
Well, visiting.
Visiting.
And yeah, it's, you know, there's no way I would have been accepted. And as you know, Needham High School,
yeah, Needham
really
High School
kicked
would have
my
haunted
butt.
You there.
Yeah, 5 years, the last two taking square dancing and wood shop just about kicked my butt. But Yale is beautiful. New Haven, not so much. And that's the dichotomy. Because if I had academic aspirations and talent, right, it would have come down to Brown or Yale. But Brown, with Providence and the waterway and the hills and the rolling hills, and Yale.
Yale is a little isolated oasis in New Haven. Or I mean, I haven't been back in a long time, and I've heard New Haven is actually, you know, is prospering in lots of different ways. But when I was there, it was definitely a little fortress in the middle of a city.
I was there just a few months ago. So
okay, I'll take your word for it.
Unless it's prospered last week, unless the fastest urban renewal program in history, like the government swept in and just. You know, it's just kind of gritty. And then you have Yale, which is one of the finest academic institutions anywhere. How much has, you know, for writers out there, for any of our listeners that are writers themselves or aspire to or have family members, how much of the process for you in your experience and your success writing comes from kind of the academic background of really understanding the technical element of writing, and how much comes from just internal communication skills and being able to reflect on what you're seeing and feeling in the outside world and then trying to convey that through a story?
That's a really good question. I definitely benefited from my education. I went to Chevres a number of years ago, back when it was all boys, and all my courses were taught by priests, and they were great. They were very rigorous and made sure that I knew my Latin,
right,
classical Greek. And then, you know, Yale is, it's a top-notch school, but I think for me, the real watershed moment of my career, as a writer was when I could let go of a lot of my academic stuff and really focus on writing about things that were important to me and that were important to readers. You know, I mean, that's what I hear more than anything else, is just that, you know, my character, Mike Bowditch, feels so authentic to readers. He feels like somebody that they know. The characters feel like they're somebody they know. The Maine that I'm describing feels real. And again, this is stuff that I didn't get from Yale. It's stuff that I had to kind of let go of in order to finally be successful as a writer. You know, the other stuff in some ways got in the way.
Isn't that the core to all great art, though, being authentic, whether it's somebody in music and really being true to the music, or somebody in terms of, acting or painting? For me, and as I interpret art, I think that resonates, and certainly with, writing. If somebody is writing from an authentic place, that's why in my early years, did you ever read any Hunter S. Thompson?
Oh, yes.
Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
Yeah, of course.
He also wrote Hell's Angels and stuff.
Yeah.
Deb, were you on that? You're shaking your head.
No, never read any of that. No.
So you skipped the classics.
I did.
Or skipped the 60s.
I was busy.
Are you serious?
That. No.
One of the Hunter S. Thompson, for me, in his style of writing, Gonzo writing, mm-hmm. Was kind of, I think it was at its root, it was about the authenticity of living in the moment.
Yes.
And his moment was heavily drug-induced.
Right.
But it was still a psychedelic moment.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the writing in the 60s, whether it was Ken Kesey, Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test, Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Robert Pirsig, which I still think is a classic. Everyone should read that.
They should.
The Art of Motorcycle, first of all, Zen is interesting, but you throw in the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance. I was with my son. We were dirt bike riding up in Ellsworth. There's a trail called the Sunrise Trail that goes from Ellsworth up to almost Canada. And he didn't want to put oil on his chain. And I'm like, who doesn't want it? He goes, Dad, I don't need it. And I'm like, it's about the process, son. You need to read, about Pirsig and Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance and how we get the bike ready and how we get it to the place. Anyhow, I just went off a tangent here. But you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m., 50 million watts of power coming over your AM radio. Deb, do you even have an AM radio?
Yes, I do, actually.
God, I don't even know if
they're good in snowstorms.
They're
good.
If they
reflect off the right snow cloud, they can go pretty far. And that's what LOB counts on. So when there's a snowstorm, they put the really good programming on because.
There you go.
No, but we're also available on WLOBradio.com. That's we live
right.
stream if people go to Tide Smart Radio, mm-hmm. and we're on iTunes.
Yeah.
Wow.
I like to put the show in the context of we have 8 billion potential listeners.
That's right.
When you throw in the internet, it's like it's really
helpful.
It's helpful. And it makes the four people listening feel like they're part of a much bigger
family. Now five. My mom's listening.
Oh, fantastic. Oh, if your mom is listening, we will chalk her up.
We've increased our audience.
We have, and again, I don't want to extend my hyperbole to our guest who doesn't need hyperbole, but we have Paul Dwern here, who is an excellent author, one of my favorites, and he is just launching his latest Mike Bowich series, a book called The Precipice. Which is great, and it just came out this last week. And so when you launch a book like this, and I know there's a business side of it, there's the art side of it, there's completing it, but are you going on tour in supporting the book? Do you do radio, other newspaper interviews, that type of thing, book signings? And for the launch of a book, talk a little bit about all the different mechanisms that in today's reality, and it's a changing landscape for authors. A lot of stuff is electronic. There's audiobooks and all kinds of stuff. So what's the business process and the marketing process like when you first launch this book, The Precipice?
Well, there's a date that's set for the launch, and the books are shipped to the physical books are shipped to stores and things and are told not to begin selling them before.
So it's all synchronized.
It's all supposed to be synchronized, and there's a lot of publicity leading up to it. There's, I do interviews before the books are coming out for review in certain pre-publication places. The idea is to generate some buzz, which is increasingly difficult because there's so much competing for attention
right.
in the modern world. And then once the book launches, I do readings and signings, and I'm fortunate that my publisher believes in moving me around and making sure that I get in front of readers it's a very pleasurable experience, especially for somebody like me who spends so much time during the year just staring in front of a computer into a computer screen,
right.
So
to actually get out and
meet readers.
Yeah,
absolutely. I could never be one of those hermit authors like J.D. Salinger, who recoils from ever talking to anybody. I'm desperate for it.
I know the whole J.D. Salinger thing, and then who's the girl that he lived with, and then
Joyce Maynard.
I don't even remember her name, but there's like this great mythology, and then she wrote her own little book.
That was Joyce Maynard,
and I'm sure J.D. was like, "What are you doing? You're supposed to be a hermit like me." I don't. And then you also have I've heard only because she's over on the production side of the studio. You have world famous communications PR expert Nancy Marshall.
I do
helping. So that's part of the whole mix, right?
It is, yeah. I mean, it's, as I said, there's a lot that's competing for your attention these days. And, ultimately, everything comes down to the book. You know, what I've found is that the best publicity is word of mouth. You know, having people read a book and say, you know, give it to their brother or, you know, gift it to their father or whatever it is.
Right.
A lot of times I'll do a reading and somebody will come up to me and say, you know, I want to apologize because I only read your books because I get them out of the library. And I said, don't apologize. I mean, for one thing, you probably wear them out, so you have to buy new ones. But you know, secondly, I mean, you're really enthusiastic. And I bet you talk about my books to other people. And they say, yeah, I do. I really like them a lot. And I tell people that I like them. And, you know, and really, that's what sells books for the most part. I mean, obviously, there are these big event books, you know, Kim Kardashian or whatever. But in the world that I live in,
I think she's known more in the photo area, area of
I
art.
I didn't think she wrote a book.
Write a book called Selfie, I think.
Oh, really?
Yes. But, I think it's just it's pictures
gee,
of herself.
That's shocking.
Yeah, I know. Surprise, right?
Yeah. And it shows a stunning lack of self-awareness on her part. If she really thinks people are engaged for what she's writing or thinking, that's just stunning. We have Paul Dworn here in the studio. Also, before I forget, his website is pauldworn.com, PAULDOIRON.com. He's on Twitter, same thing, Paul Dworn on Twitter, and also Facebook. How much is digital media? And if people go to your website or your Facebook, how much of the book do you put out there for your fans to get a feel for the book without giving too much away? If they can read the whole story in synopsis form, then they're like, I just saved $29.
No, actually, people don't want to do that. It's really interesting. I do make sure that, you know, there are excerpts of the book that appear beforehand or are on the websites. You know, I'm also fortunate because I'm published by Minotaur Books, which is a division of Macmillan, that they do audios for all the books, and I'm able to put audio excerpts on my website as well, so people are able to experience the story in a lot of different ways. But what I've found has been that people, you know, they don't want to spoil their own experience, so they want to be teased about what the next book is going to be about. But ultimately,
they want to self-regulate a little bit.
They do want to self-regulate, you know, and sometimes they can't. I mean, the book has been out at this stage for 24 hours. And this morning I woke up to emails from people who had read the book overnight.
Really?
Yeah. And wow. And some of them were just, yeah, I know. It's incredible to me, too, that they were saying, you know, the saddest thing for me is now I have to wait a year for your next one.
Yeah.
Like they've consumed, they've indulged. Yes. It's like getting the whole box of fudge at Bill and Ben's in Bar Harbor.
Yes.
Not that I did that Saturday.
But if somebody you didn't get enough popovers, clearly.
I know, but if somebody was to purchase a half a pound of fudge from Bill and Ben's Chocolate Emporium in Bar Harbor and then consume it that night and then wake up with guilt.
Hypothetically,
if someone was to do that, they would feel the same kind of guilt of going through your book and not savoring chapter by chapter by chapter.
Right.
Yep. Wow. What's your writing process? You talked about being kind of locked in a room.
Mm-hmm.
There's different styles of writing. I've spoken with authors that are very technical and disciplined, where they wake up at 7, they have one glass of orange juice, one thing of oatmeal, and from 9 to 1, they produce 1,000 words or 800 words, and then at 1, they shut off the computer and then go do something else. Is it more organic for you, where you just kind of let the story dictate how much time you spend, or do you subscribe to the kind of the approach of every day move the story, move the book, move the project forward?
Mm-hmm. In general, you know, when people ask me for advice about it, I do think that the conventional wisdom that you should write every day is true. But I come from a journalism background where I had to write every day and don't have an issue with that. I mean, if I sit down, I can start writing eventually. So I'm much less disciplined probably than I should be. Maybe if I were a little bit more regimented in my life, I would write more.
Do you use an outline?
I've tried using an outline. in part because it's a function of the publishing world where
helps keep you on track.
It keeps you on track. Your publisher wants to know what you're doing at some stage.
Yeah.
They've given you a bunch of money and they're like, what is he? Is he, you know, is he in the yeah. Bahamas at the moment, you know? Or is he actually working on the book?
It's right. Like Stacy's over Mike's cabin right now. That's all you need to know.
That's all you need to know, yeah. You know? And so, but what I find is when I do use an outline that the way I've often described it is, an outline to me is like knowing what my destination is on a road trip. And I know I need to end up in Burlington, Vermont, but I don't know how I'm going to get there today. I'm open to different possibilities depending upon what scenic, you know, where the traffic is flowing.
Right.
And I'm willing to follow it to that destination. And that's sort of how I approach my stories, which is I have an idea roughly how it's going to end. But I want to be open during the course of my writing to inspiration and you know, following it different back roads.
What about the actual writing, like the production part of it? I'm guessing you use some computer, an Apple or Windows.
Do
you use Microsoft Word or is there special software that real life novelists use that sprinkle novelist magic on the words? Or?
Well, you know, I mean, I do actually use that magical software program, and I should get an endorsement fee from them because I'm such a big booster of it. It's called Scrivener.
I've heard of that.
Scrivener?
Yes. Scrivener, yes.
It must be easy to spell. Deb, can you spell Scrivener?
Yes, actually, I can.
I doubt it. Can you? Okay, spell Scrivener without writing it down.
S-C-R-I-V-N-E-R?
E-N-E-R.
E-N-E-R, okay.
Yep.
Scrivener.
Well, I was an editor.
Chloe.
So
I'm guessing. And I'm a failed writer. So,
But, you know, I mean, ultimately.
But what's it about Scrivener that is specifically designed for a real writer?
I think, you know, Microsoft Word was a writing program designed by geeks for other geeks. And Scrivener was a writing program designed by writers who had some idea about how the process works. And, you know, it's not going to magically make you a writer. I mean, that's the thing about any of this stuff is some people do need to put, you know, handwrite their first drafts, and other people need to type them, and other people need to, you know,
dictate
or whatever.
Yeah,
we had
Tess Gerritsen, mm-hmm. who's also well known.
Yeah, she's a friend of mine too.
Yeah, what a great writer she is. She was in here a few months ago. And Rizzoli and Isles, that's her series, which is also on TNT. And I think she talked about handwriting out on a piece of paper, and then when you look at, like, you know, sometimes we think about time and modern time as being almost infinite, but it's finite. You know, there's only been computers for 30 or 40 years, and there's only been mechanical typewriters for like 60 years before that. And then, like, that guy, Shakespeare. How do you write that stuff and then without editing and without spell check? How does that stuff ever happen?
I don't know.
You know what I mean? It's like now I struggle with Microsoft and spell check and how it's formatted.
Although, let me tell you something, that there is an advantage to just getting words down, even if they're horrible, because I think that most people who aspire to write run into problems because they just don't finish. And it's a lot easier if you finish something, even if it's lousy, to go back and make it better than it is if you're halfway done and you give up.
But that's kind of like life its own self.
It is,
you know, which is a title of another one of my favorite authors. Can anyone name the author of the book Life Its Own Self?
Gee, is it Steve-O?
No. Anyone? What's the name of that movie? Anyone? McFly? Anyone? Nothing? No,
nothing,
Dan Jenkins.
Nothing.
Dan Jenkins.
Oh, Dan Jenkins, of course.
Was
yes.
one of my favorite writers in the 70s, 80s. He wrote for Sports Illustrated,
right.
And then he went to Golf Digest, and he's like 80 years old now, and he still writes.
North Dallas 40.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. And dead solid perfect. And so Dan, and he had this really funny kind of stream of consciousness thing. And, but yeah, Life Its Own Self, that was the segue. Here on Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, we don't need much of an opening to take an off-ramp into any other segue in the whole world. But yeah, life its own self is just doing it, you know, whether it's the Nike slogan, just do it, having to do with fitness or athletics, or whether you're saying getting something down on paper. Mm-hmm. Too many people face any challenge in any dimension or aspect of their life, and they kind of say, well, that's a little challenging. I'm going to stop. I'm going to stop writing. I'm going to stop working out. I'm going to, you know, in my commitment to eating donuts,
daily.
I refuse to give up. Yeah. There are some people that are just like, hey, donuts. I'm kidding.
I was talking to somebody who was working at my publishing company about the process of writing a novel. And I said, you know, it is like hiking the Appalachian Trail. It's something that you do step by step. Yeah. And it takes you months, and sometimes you don't feel like you're making any progress, but ultimately it is a long, long journey to get to the end. And then sometimes you do look back and say, I don't know if it was worth it, or I hope it was worth it.
Well, that's where you and I have something in common. By the way, you're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB 1310. We've got Paul Dworn here. He is the author of the new book that just came out this last week, The Precipice. Please go to Amazon, go to any of your online bookstores, or if you're close by to your favorite local bookstore, we certainly like to support local bookstores and their business. A big theme, which I want to, in our last few minutes, I want you to kind of give an overview of The Precipice for listeners in terms of, I've already covered Stacy and all that kind of debauchery.
Well, that's the most important.
That is the most. It was the best experience of his life. And, I don't even know how he could focus on finding the hikers. But anyhow, a big part of your story involves the Appalachian Trail. And I read that today. And Deb, have you read my column today?
Not yet.
Really?
Is it out today?
Yeah, it's out today.
All right. I'll get it when I leave.
Yeah, I write a column.
Did you write about The Precipice too?
No, but I had an experience. Katie and I went, no, I'm kidding. No.
Okay.
No, back to the Appalachian Trail. I wrote a column saying writing is hard and writing the column is hard. And I'm paraphrasing myself because I wrote this 4 days ago. And I can't remember what I had for breakfast today. Mad cow. But I wrote about it's not hard like hiking the Appalachian Trail hard. And it's not hard like remembering all the Kardashian sister hard, but it's hard. And why am I doing this thing hard? So, you know, you should read that.
And
Paul, if you have some time,
I'd be happy to give you a critique.
You've only launched a giant book right now.
Yes.
Yesterday, so it's not like you have anything going on.
No.
But talk a little bit. I mentioned the Appalachian Trail because that's probably all we have in common with our writing skills, that we both use the Appalachian Trail recently in published work. But talk about the overview. And for people that may not be familiar with Mike Bowditch, talk a little bit about the overview of the series and what kind of happened in this book.
Well, thank you. He's a Maine game warden. And so his adventures and the crimes that he solves are all based on the Maine outdoors and have taken him all over the state. With The Precipice, I decided that I wanted to set a book in the 100-mile wilderness section of the Appalachian Trail, which is widely considered to be the most remote section of the whole 2,000-mile AT. And two thru-hikers, two young women, disappear. They're supposed to check in with their parents when they get to the other end of the 100-mile wilderness, and they don't. And so the Maine Warden Service mobilizes this massive search, which pulls Mike in and looking for these two missing women, trying to figure out where they are. And I won't give anything away, but what they find is grisly.
Grisly. Metaphorically grisly, or are we being literary?
Metaphorically grisly.
Okay. Have you hiked the Appalachian Trail yourself?
I've hiked many sections in Maine and New England. As a chauvinistic Mainer, I sort of think that this is the best part of the Appalachian Trail.
Right.
And I'm most interested in hiking, you know. The best part. So
very uncommon for Mainers to be kind of parochial.
I know.
In terms of, hasn't hurt our economy at all. No. It's like, that's the way we do it. No. If you're away, we're not going to welcome you. We've got the best trail. No, I'm kidding, of course. I love Maine. That's what I wrote in my column today, my little fake writing thing compared to your real writing thing, was I came up with 5 ways to fix Maine. Yeah.
I'd love to hear them.
Yeah, if you go online to theforecaster.net and, 5 ways to fix Maine. I got 10 comments so far saying that, you know, offering 10 ways to fix me. because I'm like, that's all you can do, readers? God, I don't know if you write, for other essays or newspapers, but the online comment thing is brutal. And some newspapers have a policy which I support, which is you can write what you want, but you have to be somewhat identified. Mm-hmm. But the anonymity thing is just kind of, and it's gotten to the point where I've got this one really nasty anonymous thing.
It wasn't me.
I had to take a step. So I called up my mother and said, Mom, you've got to stop it. You've got to stop it. I know it's you. You're the only person that knew these particular details.
Did she hang up on you?
Yeah. Well, you know my relationship with my mom, don't you? Yeah, that's a whole nother family thing. So relative to the Appalachian Trail and relative to the storyline, what other parts of this new book, which everyone needs to go out and buy, Deb, Sully, the Appalachian Trail plays a role because of the remote area. Mm-hmm. But are there any other parts of the storyline? Because, you know, the character, Mike, he solves things. He helps people.
Well, people have asked me, why did I choose a game warden to be the protagonist of this mystery series? And I've said that it's wardens in Maine are, well, for one thing, a lot of people don't understand is that they're fully authorized officers of the law.
Yeah.
They're not just sort of glorified park rangers, you know, nothing against
We had a couple of the guys from the TV show in here.
Northwoods Law, yeah.
Right. Really nice guys, but you're right. They're real deal. They're
trained at the Criminal Justice
law
Academy.
Law enforcement, if they tell you to pull over, they have the same authority as a state trooper, a state authority.
And, you know, and they're involved, I mean, in every major criminal investigation in the state of Maine. And it was like, wow, you know, what a great opportunity to write about all of Maine. I mean, the high and the low, the coast and the, you know, the mountains. It's been great. It's been a great opportunity for me to talk about issues that are going on in Maine, you know, through my fiction, too, which has really been something that's been important to me.
Well, this is exciting. I really appreciate you coming in today. I know you're doing a lot of interviews, and I think that it's great that we have people like yourself who are both committed to Maine and express and export that view through art, whether it's music or writing or TV shows, that type of thing. And I would encourage everyone to go out and buy the new book, novel by Paul Dworen. It's called The Precipice. For information, they can go to your website, pauldworen.com, Twitter, Paul Dworen, or Facebook/Paul Dworen. And I wish you much success with this, and I can't wait for the next book. And if you need a Steve-O character, consider this.
Well, nobody would ever believe it's true. That's the thing. You know?
I know.
Truth is stranger than fiction, I think.
I know. And in my case, it's, you know, you're absolutely right. So if that showed up, nobody would be, it would be too far-fetched. But thank you so much, and wish you nothing but the best of success. And thank you for being with us here today.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you. We'll be back. Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m.